Hello, my name is Dave Emery. This is side one of For the Record program number 525, interview with Sander Hicks about the big wedding. This is being recorded on September 4th of the year 2005. It is my pleasure and privilege to introduce to the audience, or reintroduce since we've had him on before, Sander Hicks, the author of The Big Wedding, a book about September 11th that is just released. Sander, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Thank you, Dave. It's good to be back.
The Big Wedding, real quick, before we get into some of the substance of the book, what does the title refer to?
The Big Wedding was a code word for 9/11 that was used by the terrorists. We were told this, or U.S. intelligence was told this by Jordanian intelligence.
Any idea what the reference might be?
Well, they needed to veil 9/11 from, or at least certain factions of what is called Al-Qaeda needed to veil it, and so they referred to it as the big party or the big wedding when they were referring to the 9/11 attacks.
It just occurred to me, just off the top of my head, it might have been some reference to the martyrdom. They get, 70 or 80 virgins or something like that once they get to heaven, and that would be a big wedding indeed. But that's a tangential point.
Right. I mean, if that's what we were told that they believed, can we be certain?
Well, the story of the milieu of September 11th is a very complicated one, and it goes around the world with international networks that course to and from the United States, among other places, and overlap the intelligence services of a number of different countries. It is a complex and very disturbing investigation, and one of the more complex and one of the most disturbing aspects of September 11th concerns the revelations of a fellow named Randy Glass, and you devote much of The Big Wedding to Randy Glass. Tell us about his background.
Sure. He was a jewelry con man. He had connections to the Gotti family and the Gambino family, but he was also very smart, and so when he was in prison, he said, hey, listen, there's this Egyptian arms dealer named Dia Moishan who's been trying to get me to do a deal. Maybe I can work with the federal law enforcement agencies and sort of turn state's evidence and go undercover. And Randy Glass is essentially a very American story. He's an adrenaline junkie by his own description. And he loved working with FBI and ATF. In fact, his handlers at FBI loved him. And they said this guy's got lots of valor. He has put his own life on the line for law enforcement. So Randy Glass was a guy that never really was living the straight life in terms of a straight job, and was, like I said, a kind of a scam artist in the jewelry world, but also had a taste for working undercover for FBI and ATF.
Now, Randy Glass, again, with the background that you've described, became the focal point, the pivot point, so to speak, of something called Operation Diamondback. We're going to get into the cast of characters that he encountered, but in a nutshell, what was Operation Diamondback?
All right, well, Dia Moishan, the Egyptian arms dealer that Randy Glass knew through his jewelry contacts, didn't just bring in your average run-of-the-mill Miami arms dealers. This guy was Egyptian. He was working with some major international Egyptian arms brokers, and they were interfacing with Pakistanis, namely Rulim Abbas, R.G. Abbas, who was an agent of the Pakistani intelligence services, the ISI. Also with Mike Malik, who was a sort of a low-level asset ISI affiliated individual. And they started pretty much asking for some pretty heavy stuff. They were asking for nuclear components, Stinger anti-aircraft missiles, and Dia Moishan was telling Randy Glass, and Randy Glass has it on tape, that these guys are working for the Taliban of Afghanistan, and they're working for Osama bin Laden, and this is as early as July of 99.
Now, again, the cast of characters: Dia Moishan, Egyptian arms dealer; R.G. Abbas, one of his associates working for the Pakistani ISI; and Mike Malik, last name M-A-L-I-K, all of them a milieu involved with securing some nasty toys for an Al-Qaeda milieu and the Taliban milieu.
Right, right. And readers of Paul Thompson's Terror Timeline book, which is an encyclopedic book that I recommend as an essential reference tool on the 9/11 enigma, well, remember that R.G. Abbas is the guy that in July of 99 was having dinner with Randy Glass and a whole bunch of undercover people that had this restaurant staked out at the Tribeca Grill. And he said, those towers are coming down, pointing up at the World Trade Center. And this is in July of 99. So Randy Glass knew that there was some sort of threat on the World Trade Center. And from July of 99 up to the summer of 2001, his undercover operation came to a halt. The ATF and FBI filed a court complaint that said that Pakistani intelligence assets are trying to buy nuclear components and Stinger anti-aircraft missiles. However, due to some sort of corruption in the U.S. judicial system, that complaint was sanitized, and all references to Pakistan and R.G. Abbas by name and Mike Malik by name were removed from the complaint. So the name Pakistan was changed to a foreign country. Randy Glass knew that there was some sort of threat on the World Trade Center, but he didn't know exactly what kind of threat. Now, if you have a minute, I'd like to play you an audio tape. Can I play your tape?
Yeah, let's listen to what you've got there. This is an audio tape of what, Sander?
Okay. This is an audio tape I made, Dave, in July of 2004, when this is after I had done a major story on Randy Glass for INN World Report Television, which is a Dish Network news show. And this was after we had already taped an interview, so I couldn't use this on air, but this is in the book, and this is a pretty major part of Chapter 1.
Okay, so this is from July of 2004. You are interviewing Randy Glass,
right,
the Stingman who was at the epicenter of Operation Diamondback, the
right
operation that we've just described. And remember that in July of 1999, Randy Glass, at the Tribeca restaurant in downtown Manhattan, while wired, we should mention that he was wired.
Oh yeah.
For this conversation with R.G. Abbas,
right,
whom in this wired situation, monitored by the FBI, said, quote, pointed to the World Trade Center towers and said, those towers are coming down. This in July of 1999. So here is your interview from July of last year, 2004, with Randy Glass.
Right. To introduce this tape properly, I must say that I'm going to ask Randy Glass a question, and I'm looking at this note that he wrote Senator Bob Graham in July of 2001. It's a very interesting note. It's actually the inside front cover of my book, printed in bright orange there, in which Randy Glass says that he's really concerned. I would like to have my case reopened so I can go back to work. I don't care about the 7 months in prison. He keeps on saying, I've gotten from the State Department about this airplanes being used, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So let me play you this tape, and I'll ask Randy Glass why he was trying to warn Senator Bob Graham about airplanes being used.
Before you roll the tape, let me punctuate for the audience. This is July of 2001. This is before the attacks.
Right.
Go
exactly
ahead.
My investigation, okay, that when I worked for the feds for 31 months.
Right.
Okay. From, I don't know, just count backwards from June, 31 months, June of 2001. I think it was in November of 98 or 97. 98, okay.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, the only thing that we heard the first time that the World Trade Center was mentioned was at the meeting at the Tribeca Grill by Abbas.
Right, but why does this sentence say that you got that information from the State Department?
Okay, I'm going to tell you.
Okay.
Okay. The only information that the terrorists, the guys ever talked about, was just the World Trade Center. They didn't ever say anything to me or to Dick, to my knowledge, that airplanes are going to be used. The State Department guy told me that. Okay? In other words, I called up, okay, and I played it, I bluffed them. I called up. See, they, I don't know what they knew that I knew. Okay? I just knew that America was going to be Trade Center or what it was going to be. These people had talked about purchasing these weapons to use against us.
Right. Did you know it was going to be attacked on 9/11?
Pardon me?
Did you know it was going to be attacked on 9/11?
No. Okay. I did not.
What was your reaction on 9/11?
I cried. I was in jail. And I called my guys from jail and said, you guys got to get me out of here. I I need to feel like I need to do something to help.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Your guys being the ATF guys?
Yeah, those guys, FBI guys, you know, several different agency numbers that, you know, like that I had, that I called.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, so anyway, so what happened was, when I called the State Department, because, see, I got sentenced, I think, on the 15th, okay, of June 2001. And I was given 60 days to self-surrender. And the marshals notify you where to surrender. Right? Okay. So it was during that time that I was making all these calls. You know, I mean, I couldn't call law enforcement or the intelligence community because they knew. And they weren't doing anything. And I knew...
They knew what?
They knew. They knew the whole case.
Right. Against a boss.
Yeah, a boss, Malik. In other words, they knew a lot more, okay, than they were let... Okay, I don't know if you know, but the intelligence business is a one-way street.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I actually have a more specific question than that, because I now, since we last talked, I've seen the Dateline piece, okay. And I've talked to Richard Greenberg a couple of times.
Right.
Good guy.
Great guy.
But he doesn't seem to be connecting all the dots that we're trying to connect. Maybe we're too overeager. Maybe he's too cautious.
Well, okay.
So my question for you is, when Dick Stoltz on Dateline says stuff like, well, gee, we really thought that FBI or CIA would have taken over this case, is it possible that the reason that the CIA didn't take over this case is because the CIA has been working with Pakistani intelligence?
Of course. That was the whole... Yeah, that was the whole thing, okay? All right, here's the deal, all right? I call, and yes, they absolutely were throughout the entire thing, okay? Now, the State Department was the vehicle that was used, all right, to shut down the case. Now, if you ask ATF or anyone, they're going to say it was their idea, okay? They don't know shit if you ask the agents. They just get their orders. They're like little marching soldiers. They're like little ants,
mm-hmm.
Okay? And they do what they're told. They could be my best friends, but if they're told to stick it in me, they're gonna.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that because they did it to me.
Yeah.
Okay? You know, on more than one occasion. And Berdowski was their instrument. Okay?
Even though he was FBI, right?
Right. Okay? So, now... when I called the State Department, because I knew that they were the ones that ordered the case shut down, I was sitting in the office when the phone call came, okay?
The case was shut down in June?
Yes.
Right, when you were terminated.
Right.
Right.
Okay. So the case was shut down in June, all right? And the complaint was ordered written. And Barberini and Berdowski were supposed to write it together and sign it together.
Mm-hmm.
Berdowski was ordered to stand down and not sign it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? This is fact. This is not, you know...
Yeah, that's good. And I want to talk to you about this, too, because, like, there's a book I'm putting out about 9/11, and I want you to be a part of that, and I want to... We'll do a big interview for that.
Okay.
But for tonight, I'm just trying to write a short intro right now.
I understand. Okay. But yeah. Okay, so here's the bottom line.
Yeah.
Okay. So now, I want to know, because these guys are all now blown away, A, the case is shut down, and they're not finished. Because we, as far as we're concerned, we have a lot more to do, and none of us have understood why it hasn't been taken away from these low-level law enforcement guys. These are domestic law enforcement agents, okay? Now, you know, they're passing, they're writing reports, they're going to Washington, and things are being investigated, but like I said, intelligence is a one-way street. Okay, so what happens is, the State Department now orders the complaint sanitized, okay? So Barberini's all pissed off because he's the guy given the job to rewrite the complaint.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look, it's a public record, you can get it off the internet. If you look, you'll see that there's no mention of Pakistan, there's no mention of us showing them plutonium, okay? I mean, there's no mention that incriminates Pakistan. I mean, Pakistan is not in there one time, okay? And these were all Pakistani people that were here, Okay. Those were the people that were orchestrating. If there was a state-sponsored group, like, you know, they say that, you know, well, we're looking for a state, you know, country.
Yeah.
To be
yeah, no, I know what you're going to say, and we already agree on that.
Right,
that,
okay.
That Pakistan is all over this thing. And,
right.
And,
okay. So the bottom line is, okay, so when I called the State Department, I said to them, listen, I already know about the World Trade Center. Okay, so they assumed that I knew more than I did.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't. I didn't know anything about airplanes.
Who are you talking to at the State Department?
Well, okay, this guy Chuck Hunter, okay, and then this other guy, to be honest with you, I couldn't tell you his name.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Because of you don't want to tell me his name?
Well,
you don't think it'd be prudent?
There's two reasons, okay? I know who it is, but he didn't want to tell me, but I had my ways and I found out.
Right.
Okay? So, you know, the bottom line is that, you know, if you check, and I've told so many people this, all you have to do is pull my phone records. I'll sign any release.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? There were at least 6 phone calls, and we're not talking 30-second, hi, how are you, I can't talk about it, goodbyes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about lengthy phone calls.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? At least a half a dozen.
Okay, so you bluffed, and you sort of pretended like you knew more than you did, and then what did they tell you?
But I didn't even really, like, have to do that. I just said what I knew.
Yeah.
I said, look, listen, I know that the World Trade Center is going to be attacked.
Right.
Okay? All right? And then, you know, this guy said to me, Randy, listen, you know, you cannot mention any of these things, you know, especially, you know, airplanes being used to fly into the World Trade Center. And when he said that,
I almost fell out of my chair. That's what he's going to say. Are you guys still there?
Yeah, we're here. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sorry that went on a long time, but that just you'll have to edit it and use the last bit there, because that's the bit I was trying to get to. I thought the tape was queued up better to that point.
Okay. So now, we've been listening to a conversation that you had with Randy Glass
over
the telephone in July of last year, 2004.
Exactly. Trying to polish the broadcast that we did about him for INN World Report Television. And that was pretty much a bombshell. He didn't talk about that on air, but he talked about it with me on the phone afterwards, and I happened to be taping the call. And that's why I realized how important he is to the story of 9/11. What he told us, just to recap, is that he knew about some threat against the World Trade Center. He called a State Department top brass official that he knew, and this State Department guy said, we know all about the threat on the World Trade Center, and don't tell anyone that you know something about planes being flown into the World Trade Center. And Randy Glass was flabbergasted because he didn't actually know anything about a specific planes being flown into the World Trade Center threat, but he did know about a threat from his Pakistani sources, but somehow the State Department officials that he called, the top guys, right-hand men of Colin Powell at the time, they told him that they already knew about planes being flown into the World Trade Center in July of 2001. So if Randy Glass is credible and can be believed, and the FBI thinks he can be believed because they trusted him and they've gone on record saying how credible and valorous he is, then we've got a major problem here. Because if the State Department already knew about planes being flown into the World Trade Center in July of 2001, then we have your first major evidence of distinct foreknowledge of the 9/11 attack.
And again, that conversation that Randy Glass was recounting to you took place in the midsummer July of 2001, a couple of months before the attack.
That's right. And I did some gumshoeing and dug up as much as I could. I talked to Randy Glass about 10 or 15 more times after that and made a lot of tapes. I got a whole box here of tapes and tried to get more information on exactly who that State Department top guy was. And Randy is pretty smart, pretty cagey guy. He doesn't want to completely burn sources, and he still has pretty close ties to people high up in CIA and NSA. So he didn't want to completely irk too many people. But he was able to give me enough clues that I think I'm pretty, about 80 to 90% certain that his State Department source was Francis X. Taylor.
Now,
Who used to be Colin Powell's head of security. He's got a background at the Air Force Office of Special Investigations, or OSI, which is effectively the CIA of the Air Force.
It is Air Force Intelligence is what
right.
it is.
Yeah. Air Force Intelligence, right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So now you allege that the person that Randy Glass was talking to, the State Department official, who mentioned that Randy Glass, should not discuss planes being flown into the World Trade Center. You allege that that individual was Frank or Francis Taylor.
Yeah, well, I don't know if I allege it per se, but I say that all best evidence points towards this conclusion without having to actually allege it point blank. But the interesting thing about Francis Taylor is he left the Air Force and joined the State Department in July of 2001.
Mm-hmm.
So there was obviously a reason for him to come there, and there's also racial and voice characteristics that match the description that Randy Glass gave me. If you look at Francis Taylor or Frank Taylor's background too, he was being treated as a high-level diplomat. He actually traveled to Pakistan with Condoleezza Rice right around that time.
So we'll put an asterisk by the potential identification of Francis Taylor.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. One of the things that you bring out in The Big Wedding, once again talking about Randy Glass, once again talking about Operation Diamondback, with not only the startling revelation of R.G. Abbas, those towers are coming down in July of 99, and now with the conversation he had with State Department personnel, who apparently knew of a plan to fly planes into the World Trade Center. And by the way, just parenthetically, I would inject that there were warnings coming in for years about the development of these plans, and specifically to use a hijack aircraft as kamikaze. So this is not out of context for the investigation.
Correct, correct. And when Condoleezza Rice said that we had no idea that they would use planes as kamikaze weapons or words to that effect, that became one of the most flagrant violations of the truth when so many different government agencies were warning. Even former CIA asset Brad Ayers actually wrote a report for FEMA in the 80s that said that terrorists might use this attack method. And we can get more into Captain Brad Ayers later because I know a lot about him. But there's a clear cover-up going on here. And what I'm trying to do in my book, The Big Wedding, Dave, is combine the incredibly compelling firsthand testimony of people like Randy Glass, Brad Ayers, Richard Taus, Ambassador Wanta, other people like that, with hardcore, well-researched, scientific, historical inquiry that pays special attention to financial crime, underreported crimes of the ruling class, the kind of stuff they don't teach you in high school and really should.
Before we have about 3 or 4 minutes left on this side, Sander, Robert Graham, outgoing senator from Florida, who was quite outspoken in certain respects, he was aware of the information that had been disseminated by Randy Glass and was actually interviewed in 2002 by someone on a Florida television station, was he not?
That's right. In fact, I just talked to her, a young reporter named Kathleen Walter, who actually returned my phone call when I mentioned Randy Glass's name and her voicemail, and she was eager to hear that she was in the book and that Randy Glass was in the book, because she was the one that confronted Senator Bob Graham and said, is it true that this guy, Randy Glass, interviewed you or confronted you with this information? And Senator Bob Graham admitted that, yes, Randy Glass had warned him. And Bob Graham, I think, handed in very unsatisfactory, obfuscating answers about Randy Glass and was not very forthcoming about why he didn't act on this information. The most alarming thing that 9/11 researchers know about Senator Bob Graham is that he was actually meeting with General Mahmoud Ahmed, the head of Pakistani ISI, on the morning of 9/11. For some reason, he found himself in this breakfast meeting with the head of the Pakistani spy agency and Porter Goss, the current head of CIA.
One thing I wanted to interject parenthetically, the audience has heard some programs dealing with another very important new book, one that I think in many ways complements your book, and that is the book Prelude to Terror by Joseph J. Trento. So for some of the machinations vis-a-vis Pakistani and also Saudi intelligence and how some of the many wires here got crossed, I think there's a good background in that book about how the, quote, war on terror, unquote, wound up basically getting the Pakistanis off the hook in a lot of ways, and there are ongoing questions, of course, about just to what extent the, quote, war on terror, unquote, is really being waged by
Pakistan. Yeah, I totally second that, David. That's a great reference. I just read cover to cover Prelude to Terror by Joseph Trento, and I'm not fit to undo that man's sandal strap, because my book, The Big Wedding, is 200 pages, and it covers a lot of ground, but he really dives in hardcore, dives in deep, and does stuff over the course of 500 pages on the background of all the relationships that you have to understand to really understand 9/11. And Trento has written The Secret History of the CIA, and now his new book, Prelude to Terror, all about rogue CIA, Ted Shackley, George Herbert Walker Bush, et cetera, et cetera. But he, I think by writing a book called Prelude to Terror, which spends so much time analyzing relationships that are important and underreported and essential to understanding 9/11, I think what he's doing is getting the world ready for an incredible 9/11 book, because when his 9/11 book comes out, it's going to be written in the context of his other scholarly work.
Well, it's a very important book, and listeners to this program have already heard about the Safari Club, one of the central elements in the privatized network that he talks about, and there's another program in the can about how the Safari Club led directly to the birthing of the AQ Khan network and the Islamic bomb. Sandra, we're almost out of time on this side. Tell listeners where they can get Big Wedding and give them your website and any relevant information, that contact information, et cetera, that you think they should have.
Sure. My book's called The Big Wedding. It's available in bookstores nationwide. It's distributed by SCB. And if you want to get it online, you can please do get it at voxpopnet.net, voxpopnet.net. It should be available through Ingram and all the other book channels that people normally use. It's on Amazon, et cetera, et cetera.
All righty, and I also want to alert listeners to the Spitfire website, www.spitfirelist.com, with links to all kinds of things, including websites maintained by sister station WFMU that is archiving all of the For the Record broadcasts for future use, and is also podcasting the programs as well. So the interview that we're doing right now, FTR 525, will be podcast and archived for posterity. And there are links to a number of other things, books, websites, on the Spitfire website as well, www.spitfirelist.com. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 525, interview with Sandra Hicks about The Big Wedding. This has been recorded on September 4th of 2005. For Sandra Hicks, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.